Good morning. As everyone said, I'm Melissa Brodowski. I work at the Office on Child Abuse and Neglect at the Children's Bureau, which is essentially the federal agency that is responsible for child abuse and neglect, child welfare, foster care. We're within the Administration for Children and Families, which is basically the human services side of Health and Human Services. So anyway, I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very pleased to be invited to be part of this panel. We work very closely with Yingying, of course, around the data that they're collecting, but also providing support to our states and other grantees. So. And I also just want to say I do have, my background is in social work and public health, so I really do come at it from those two issues that I feel like are really central and need to be integrated. So I've had the benefit of having lots of folks in the prevention field really reinforce the importance of child abuse prevention. I remember talking to someone recently who really said, it must be really challenging for you to work at an agency that is so focused really on, you know, sort of the tertiary side, the abuse side, the foster care side, to really bring up the issue of child abuse prevention as a public health issue. And I said, yes, it is challenging, but I think it's even more important for people like us to have those kinds of voices within the system. So what I wanted to share was in this overview, which is a very nice segue to what Yingying was presenting, trying to share a little bit of how we're thinking about child maltreatment prevention and this idea really fairly recently with our new leadership around promoting well-being, talk about some of the themes that have come up in prevention. I've been working in my position for the last 10 years, so I've really had a benefit of getting to know and hear about lots of issues from the states that are coming up that are very relevant to public health as well. Give some examples of what we're doing in our office, and then also some of our interagency partnerships, and then some of the challenges and opportunities. I hope to have a little bit more good news, but there's also bad news always at the same time in what I'm going to share. So just to say, as I said, we're a division within the Children's Bureau. If you think about the child welfare system, the Office on Child Abuse and Neglect is kind of the front end of child welfare. We really deal with the upfront prevention, child protective services, child abuse and neglect. Our authorizing legislation is essentially the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. This is our website from the Children's Bureau for more information. I meant to say that the budget, just to give you in context, since we're talking about numbers and costs, so the budget at the Children's Bureau is almost $8 billion, of which I think almost $6 billion goes to support Title IV-E, which is basically child welfare foster care. If you think about prevention dollars, I would say, to be generous, it's probably maybe up to a couple hundred million that we may be invested in. I would say that sort of includes a bunch of other things. So obviously, it's just really kind of a drop in the bucket in terms of what our agency is spending. Some studies that came out a couple years ago from Prevent Child Abuse America actually estimated the cost of child abuse and neglect to society to be about $105 billion if you really add in foster care, special education, healthcare, et cetera. So it's definitely high cost. At our office, I'll share a little bit of some of these examples of what we're doing, but we really like to think about it along these multi-level prevention strategies around supporting state and local efforts, building the evidence base around effective programs, public awareness, and then our interagency partnerships. I wanted to just highlight, I think, some of the exciting things that's happening with some of our new leadership. Brian Samuels is now the commissioner for the Administration for Children and Youth and Families, which oversees Children's Bureau, and the Family and Youth Services Bureau, which oversees domestic violence, runaway homes. He's very interested in really talking more about this idea of well-being. Our key outcomes in the Children's Bureau around child welfare is basically safety, permanency, and well-being. And that's all the things that we're trying to work on. But over the last several years, really the focus in terms of working with states has really emphasized safety and permanency, obviously the protection and ensuring permanent homes. But, you know, recognizing, and I think on the prevention side, this is basically what a lot of the professionals are working on, this idea of social-emotional well-being. How do we really promote positive outcomes for families? And this is a slide from our commissioner that he shared with our staff within ACYF around really looking at the basically sort of nurture nature research and what's coming out over the last several years about the intersection between biological development and childhood experiences, and how all that comes together as well as culture, to influence behavior and relationships and ultimately what we can do around well-being. So we're having some really good conversations about what this might mean. I'm very excited about this kind of emphasis in terms of our work because it resonates very much so with what child maltreatment prevention advocates have been really trying to emphasize around the importance of the child and the family and what's really happening with them. Yingying had mentioned, this is a framework that we use as well. I know public health is very familiar with this whole primary, secondary, tertiary prevention. The focus of the work that I've been involved in has really been around the primary prevention and secondary prevention efforts. The services that we fund, albeit a small percentage of the services, but really trying to get at prevention of abuse before it even happens. And then for those families that are identified at risk, especially those families that may have been reported to CPS, but cases are closed, not substantiated, there's still an incredible need to address those issues. And then really, traditionally, in terms of the rest of the work of our Bureau around the tertiary prevention. But the reality is also just to think about, that, you know, families fall along this range of continuum in terms of what they present to services and also the way organizations are actually organized and provided isn't that clean in terms of these distinctions. So I think that's the other thing to kind of recognize. What's been a really helpful framework, the Institute of Medicine had came out with this report that some of you may be familiar with, Preventing Mental Health Disorders in Youth, in 2009. And I think what we're trying to really focus on now is even around prevention before universal is really this idea of promotion and promoting protective factors, really promoting the kinds of behaviors and relationships and it within individuals, families, and communities that can help promote optimal development. So I think we're trying to go in that end, but realizing obviously it has to be this whole continuum of services that'll be available. And the linkages across all those services are critically important in terms of the handoffs that need to happen across those things, I think are important. So just to highlight, you know, kind of the things that we've really been grappling with and struggling with and challenges, as well as opportunities in prevention, I think this whole critical issue of understanding that we need to provide some services to families, but then really measuring and evaluating the impact of prevention. I think the perennial challenge of prevention programs is how do you measure something when you're trying to prevent something from not happening in the first place, right? So that's always this issue of what kind of evaluation methodology you need to use, the kinds of questions that we're struggling with, and the need to generate more of that evidence. And then once you find effective programs or evidence-informed programs, how you really implement and sustain those programs to the scale and quality that actually can provide an impact on families. And then I think some of the exciting discussions that's happening among prevention, child maltreatment prevention, is the linkage with early childhood systems, is really the broader discussion. And how do we link with healthcare? How do we link with medical home initiatives? How do we link with pre-K, early care, and education strategies that are going on? A key focus of a lot of the programs that we work with, too, is this idea of the importance of actually integrating parents as partners in the planning, development, evaluation of prevention programs. Those are key pieces that we're really trying to integrate in our work. And then finally, especially as the federal government, really trying to generate the knowledge around these effective programs, but then how do we disseminate those in an effective way, and how do we integrate that information into ongoing work and using data to inform decision making? So I think those are sort of the key issues that we're all grappling with at this point in terms of all the work that we're doing. It's very exciting and very challenging at the same time. This graphic just is to show you in terms of the work that I was just going to highlight around the socio-ecological framework, really recognizing that we need to have strategies at all levels, at the individual, family, community, and societal levels, understanding those impacts. Just a couple minutes on some of the state and local initiatives, at least funded through our office. The Community-Based Child Abuse Prevention Program is actually a program authorized out of Title II of CAPTA. It's what we call a state formula grant program. Every state receives these dollars. It's almost $42 million not a lot of money in the whole scheme of things, though some may also say $42 million is still $42 million. The whole idea of this is supporting direct child abuse prevention programs and activities. There's a lead agency that the governor designates in every state, and as you can see, they're most often children's trust funds. You may be familiar with them. Sometimes they're housed in child welfare. A few of them are housed in public health agencies. We have a couple of nonprofits. I think the other key piece about what this program does, it's not just providing direct services, but it's also doing the infrastructure development around bringing together the network of prevention programs in the states, conducting training, public awareness and evaluation. So really being that advocate and leverage within the state to support those efforts. The kind of programs typically funded, again, these are the direct services, not surprising, the kinds of programs you probably would think would be prevention, home visiting, parent education, mutual support, family resource centers, et cetera. And what we've been doing over the last 5 to 6 years has really been, you know, with this whole emphasis, as you all are aware, of the push to evidence-based programs, evidence-informed programs, we've really worked with our grantees to ensure that they're funding a range of programs that are evidence-informed or evidence-based. And we very intentionally have communicated the importance of funding a range of programs along that continuum, knowing that there has to be this idea of a balanced portfolio of programs that states are funding. So this is just a graphic that shows we've talked to them about the importance of both the emerging innovative programs, promising programs, supported and well-supported. There's certain definitions that we're using. We know there's lots of different federal agencies and initiatives that also use these programs. One of their outcome measures is actually to increase the percentage of programs funded that are evidence-informed as well as evidence-based. So we've been really working closely around providing technical assistance and support. I think the interesting conversations about that is, then you get to, well, what is really being implemented, right? Because I think the other discussion around this whole evidence-based issue is, just because a program is labeled evidence-based, sometimes there may not be a clear articulation of actually what are those key components to a degree well enough that people can understand how it's being implemented. So this cartoon actually comes from Brian Baumgartner at Penn State University. There's a prevention research network. And I think this is sort of the crux of some of the challenges around trying to implement things well. You really have to understand the theory and practice, and there has to be enough sort of components to measure fidelity. And the little cartoon, if you can't see it, there's sort of two people talking, this really complex formula, and then the middle says, then a miracle occurs, and then the rest of it, and then it says, I think you should be more explicit in step two. So I think what we're finding is that people really recognizing there needs more support for people to be able to do high quality implementation. And that is the challenge, right? It's this opportunity and a challenge, and that requires lots of technical assistance. Even with the original model developers of these evidence-based programs, some, you know, vary in their capacity to support replication. Knowing that the other piece that we like to try to do in terms of using the federal dollars to invest in research and demonstration projects around effective programs, there's another sort of piece of our portfolio where we really do fund competitive grants out to the country around certain initiatives. So I just wanted to highlight two of them. There's a number of other initiatives going on. We have a quality improvement center on early childhood that's really focused on examining prevention of abuse and neglect strategies, particularly for the youngest children, 0 to 5, acknowledging all the research around those children being the most vulnerable, having the highest rates of substantiation, but also recognizing that there needs to be collaborative efforts to promote this idea of protective factors and prevention. So that's what that Quality Improvement Center is doing. They're funding 4 different research and demonstration projects that are testing collaborative interventions that are trying to promote protective factors to prevent the likelihood of abuse and neglect. Lots of really interesting work that's happening there. We also funded a set of projects across the country to support the scale-up of evidence-based home visiting programs. I'll talk in a minute about the newer program now out of the Affordable Care Act, but this is a precursor to that. And these set of projects are really trying to generate more knowledge about what it takes to really build that infrastructure, support high-quality implementation, and sustain it over time. The other piece that our office does is around education and awareness at the national level. And so what we do, and some of you may have seen some of this, is we work very closely, actually, with both federal partners as well as non-federal partners to develop what we call a resource guide that's really strategies on what individuals can do, what communities can do around prevention. But I would say in the last 5 years, we don't even call it, it used to be our child abuse prevention resource packet, but now we don't even call it that. We call it our Strengthening Families and Communities Guide. It really has been focused around promoting protective factors. There's still obviously a piece of it that talks about what is child maltreatment, but what we're really trying to put out there is recognizing that sometimes people need to recognize that signs of stress in families, you know, sort of at the earliest level, what can be done to help those families before they reach the extreme. And in some ways, if you think about child abuse, is really the most extreme form of negative parenting. And so this, in a way, is some ways to educate and work with our partners around providing some information. And credit really need to acknowledge the Center for the Study of Social Policy, who's really, we use their framework, adapted their promoting protective factors framework within this guide, and we work closely with them. I wanted to just say a few minutes, and I want to make sure there's time for some discussion around the federal interagency partnerships and collaboration that we're doing. There's a number of we have a federal interagency work group on child abuse and neglect that's really been in existence since the 1980s. There's over 40 federal agencies that basically do some level of touching around the issue of child maltreatment, NIH, Department of Defense, Agriculture, SAMHSA, et cetera. And I think there's just lots of discussions that we've had over the years around what everyone is doing and recognizing that we all need to play a part. So just to highlight some of the things, CDC is actually a key partner in a lot of our work. Some of you may be familiar that child maltreatment has been identified as a priority at CDC. They've put out this framework around promoting safe, stable, and nurturing relationships, which is very much in line with this idea of promoting protective factors. SAMHSA has another initiative around Project Launch, which is promoting wellness and really addressing those kind of issues across the state. Maternal and child health, over the years, has promoted this idea of early childhood comprehensive systems. Their family support component, I will say, is very much sort of grounded and working collaboratively with the prevention folks along the state. So I think there's some exciting synergies that have happened along the way and challenges. So I think I'll just have to say that, you know, there's some a lot of coming together, and yet there's still a lot that needs to be worked out, in, I think, in terms of these discussions. Some exciting work culminated last year, a collaboration with the Department of Education and HHS around really looking at early childhood systems. This is just a highlight of a report that came out that really profiles some of the work that's happening in the states in terms of creating integrated systems and some of the recommendations around really paying attention to the most vulnerable families and this idea of focusing on adverse childhood experiences, child maltreatment. There's nice examples of state work that's going on there representing the child abuse prevention efforts. So there's a link and to that report. And then I think I would say prior to that is this whole, you know, early learning challenge fund opportunity from the Department of Education is another thing to watch. Our office is working closely with the Maternal and Child Health Bureau on this new Maternal, Infant, and Early Childhood Home Visiting Program, which some of you may have heard that was in the Affordable Care Act. I think we're very excited, obviously, to be part of that. The research around home visiting, showing you know, the outcomes related to child maltreatment prevention. I think the sort of bad news side of the coin there is we want to be really careful that we're not kind of over-promising and under-delivering. I think now we look at sort of home visiting as the magic bullet and answer to everything, and I think we recognize it's just one piece of that. And I think that's the part that, you know, we definitely feel it's important for multiple partners to be part of. In terms of that particular announcement, there's requirements for letters of support from a range of different agencies to be part of the application. So the Child Welfare Agency has to be signing off on this, the MCH Bureau, the Child Care Lead, the Head Start recommendations for domestic violence, all those benchmark areas that this program is supposed to address. I think the implementation, you know, not to minimize, it's very exciting, and I think some of you maybe who are involved with the planning of that, it's a great investment in additional resources, but it comes at a time when other resources are being cut. So, I mean, I think, we're trying to scale up this program when other existing resources are actually disappearing. So that's a big challenge. And then just to say, Deb Darrow, I don't know if you know, if folks know Deb Darrow from Chapin Hall. She's just, I want to be Deb Darrow when I grow up, but she's just really fabulous. So she shared, you know, some of the issues around prevention, which I think really is thinking about these technical challenges, adaptive challenges that face prevention efforts right now. And I think this idea of, you know, finding solutions to what we can do, and people agree we have to create new programs, provide services, build partnerships, mobilize people. We get that. We all get that we're supposed to do that. But the challenge is, how do we really transform communities? How do we bring this together? How do we achieve this consistent quality in these programs that we're trying to implement? How do we really provide incentives for meaningful collaboration, not just kind of parallel play, as some would say, that some of it. And then this whole idea of this personal responsibility for well-being. I think the child abuse community has done a great job of awareness around child abuse as a serious issue. I don't think we've done as good a job of, okay, what can people actually do, you know what I mean, in terms of the individuals, communities, and sites around addressing this issue. And then just to say that we're working on this whole network for prevention that we convened last year, that we're continuing to convene next year. The National Conference on Child Abuse and Neglect is coming up next year, 100-year anniversary of the Children's Bureau. We'll have more discussions. So I think that's probably it. I mean, I can see Michael standing. He's like telling me to stop. But I think it's really just, we have to continue working with all of you around these issues. It's complex, and we need the partners. So
what do you guys have to say to us out there? I can add some more bad news comments to my specialty particularly. I mean, it is interesting to listen to sophisticated and thoughtful policy and orientation and responsibility, while the District of Columbia Child Protective Service has been in under court receivership for, 16, 18 years. And something gets lost in transition. And what has been very helpful to me a couple of times, and I would suggest it for everybody that makes this stuff happen, is that at least once a year you go out with someone and knock on a door. And it's interesting, this tiny female cop asking this rather large, athletic-looking guy for his belt. That's what he used to whip the kid with. And I was thinking, you can have my belt. We can get out of here. Then anyhow. Does anybody here work out there? Knock on doors? What do you do?
Oh, no, that I don't do. I'm more of a supposed reporter. And the reason you don't get numbers, and this is from across the country, not just in my city, you call CPS, and they say, what do you want me to do about it? Dead serious. Had it last week.
Well, okay.
So they didn't take the report. So it doesn't show up in your statistics. And it's not my city. It's people who are, from what I understand, from a CPS standpoint, overworked, underpaid, underloved, and undertrained.
Yeah, fire guys are the only people that are really doing well. People like it. But you see, a reporter for newspaper, journalism?
No. I'm a clinician.
Oh, okay. Reporting.
So it's frustrating when.
Right. That if.
I'm required by law to report, and yet if I try to report, they won't take it.
And
so
if they do take it, then
my license is in jeopardy, not to mention this giant.
No, there are many ways this whole thing can go wrong. What I am impressed, though, is if As long as we stay in our little separate areas, we'll never get there. If you get out with someone else, and then someone says, I'll tell you about reporters, how they cover up the nice families, the one, whatever it is. And yet, I think, if I was going to be abused kids now, or abused kid when I started doing this back in the 70s, I'd much rather be abused now. I think I got a much better chance of getting some. Yes.
I have an answer for her, though, when she gets that. If they say to you, what do you want us to do? And you're a clinician, right?
Yes.
Right. And so what you say is, I think this family needs a home visit because I only see a very small part of this child's life. And this small part has got me extremely concerned. I think CPS needs to go to the home.
It helps if you put the word death in there occasionally.
I'm sorry?
But yes, we would.
That he said if you mentioned death. Well, right.
Well, if you think, but wait, we had one here and then we'll come here. Yes, you, someone here raised? Yes, there.
I was interested in the one little line in there that said affecting the political process and Christmas child abuse. I'm from Florida, and every time there is a well publicized child death, just about every time, they create a blue ribbon panel to study what happened. And I've been on two of those myself so far. Every single one of the panels has made the same recommendation in terms of additional funding and program change. Not once has there been any of those recommendations implemented. Now, I realize that the legislation in Florida may not be exactly as sensitive to these issues as other legislations, but I would imagine that it's pretty much the same everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I would like to get some feedback about what you think about all that, because it's so frustrating.
Well, I'm sorry, this lady's going to ask a question for you too, but I think if you recommend something that costs a lot of money, that's a nice place for people to hide. I think if you break it down to little tiny pieces, you can get a little bit farther, but let's get this, we'll come back to that. Yes, you would.
Well, it sort of better relates to what you were saying. I'm from New York State, and we have a thousand, every time a kid dies, yeah. Same thing. Same group of people meeting up in Albany, same recommendation. But I think what's very interesting is I just came off of a Friday, I heard Jack Schoenfeld speak again. Your presentation was an echo of a lot of that sort of toxic stress discussion. And to steal his story, he told a story of going to Kansas and using the discussion about toxic stress in the early years and that prevention. Didn't tell the legislator anything, and then at the end of the conversation, this legislator in Kansas, which is not the most liberal, probably less liberal than New York State, I can really go out on a ledge and say that, it was like, this reminds me of our foster care program. The kids moving from here to here. So I think the science and I'm wondering if how we frame it, I heard a little bit of that coming through Melissa's talk, mm-hmm. but sort of framing the problem and framing the outcomes, like if the child's experience child abuse, their C-reactive protein at 40 years of age is, you know, four times. So another individual who didn't have child abuse. So, you know, changing the conversation and framing the long-term consequences of child abuse separately. It's not any different than it was in 1970. The long-term consequences for kids that got victimized of child abuse were just as bad. But perhaps
let me suggest there is this difference is you can see with Oprah who got people to do stuff and who just says, I am this television, what I'm a famous person, I am Miss America,
right.
and it happened to me, then you're not so alone. Because I remember being on an airplane, you know, you're right next to somebody, and this lady next to me says, my father molested me, and I'm thinking, I was writing something on that.
Sure.
I was the second person she told that. I had a half a dozen soccer moms telling me separately that I grew up with these, and I introduced them to each other. I mean, you're less alone. What is the terrible problem to me is the system is flat out dishonest because it doesn't get measured. If you got some 8-year-old kids playing soccer, they're so cute, they're so funny, and some of them are pretty good. We keep score. how many kids in your county were reported what happened to them? And you can't tell me. Ying Ying, this thing she's got is going to get us closest than anything.
Right, she's got the closest stuff.
But that is big stuff at a distance. California, how many child deaths do we have? We extrapolate numbers to estimate. Anyhow, who else has a question or answer? Oh, and then this lady is introducing you to the Family Violence Prevention Forum. That is, you go there and you meet people, and we're going to cause world peace.
By tomorrow.
But any, what other questions? Because we really didn't finish with your question.
Well, I'm not sure my question is one that can be answered. I think I'm kind of expressing my frustration. There has been a shift, though, in the findings. The labor committees, the last committee, was more law enforcement oriented and said that they found, unlike the earlier committees that made a lot of recommendations, that there was an unwarranted bias on the part of the child protective system towards families, which I thought was disheartening.
Well,
towards families.
But what does that mean?
They were supporting families too much.
That they were too much in people's lives.
No, that they supported families too much.
Right.
Well, yeah, if in doubt, kids tend to go home, and it's hard for a kid not to go home. But if someone was asking for funding, say, General Motors or someone like that was asking for funding, then one of the seemed to me logical thing is how are you doing and how'd you get to where you are and where are you planning to get yourself to next? And if people say, our caseloads are too high, I'd say, okay, but what are you doing? What happens to kids that we see? How many kids did you see? We're working this in L.A. County, and what we're finding, as I said, I cannot tell which hospital made the report because you keep spelling the hospital name differently. And a lady from our coroner's office said, I don't mind helping the hotline, how do you spell Kaiser Permanente? I do mind helping them spell the word hospital.
I'm just saying
everybody has lousy data. CDC, those are smart people, doesn't publish data on kids with gonorrhea. Public Health Service cannot tell you how many of the teenage girls in LA County, we can't tell you how many of them are pregnant or have a baby. And we're in the role of parent. And if you say, just tell me about how many kids came in and what happened to them, any systems, health, mental health, hospitals. Anyway, it is, I think, just enormously better. And I am pleased, because I'll tell you, I've been trying this. I had some real good people get up here, and I say, you have to say something, just anything, that is bad news. Now, I think you guys are a little too gracious, actually, but you put it up there. You said, this is a problem, and that's part of doing this better, is saying we're in trouble. And comparing, in my mind, the District of Columbia has been under court ordered because they can't manage it by some standard, and here are all these federal agencies with all of these beautiful programs, and something is not connected. And I think it's the same thing wherever you guys are from. Real quick, where are you from? Yes?
Me, I'm from the Maternal and Child Health Bureau.
Here, okay. Where are you from?
I'm from Northern New York.
Okay. Up there in the woods.
Yes. I'm in Indiana.
Okay.
Honolulu.
Very good.
Florida.
Tampa.
Nashville.
Maryland. Nebraska. I just have a quick question. Sure. These are mandatory reporting state. Mm-hmm. What's the data out there on that for those? Because I heard you say that with mandatory reporting, the people are mandatory reporting, the numbers are a little bit higher. I'm just curious when it blanketed across the state.
Oh, you mean public also? You mean the public?
Everyone. We are everyone.
Well, that's an interesting thing. We should look at that. We've never looked at that. Whether, first of all, the rates are higher. You would think the rates are higher, but not necessarily. There are a lot of states that everybody's mandated to report.
Sure. Right. We're not talking intimate partner violence.
No.
And where are you from?
That's interesting.
I'm from Minnesota.
You are?
Yeah. Where are
you from?
New York City.
Anyway, thank you, guys.
Just out of curiosity, the 44%
power of travel.
Yeah.
Facility.
Yeah.
On the southeast side of the United States.
Oh.
So that's a major issue of the funding we get.
Yeah.
And it's facilities.
Yeah.
What's on the bill.
Anytime. Thank you.
Anyway, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.